Hello, my name is Danny Flood. Thank you so much for listening. This audio interview is brought to you by Open World Magazine, the ultimate guide for living the adventurous life. I am so excited today because I am joined by a very special guest. His name is Mike Spencer Bown. He has been called the world's most extensively traveled man by publications such as the Huffington Post, the Daily Mail, Calgary Sun, and at least a dozen other publications. He has been traveling since 1991, and I just wanted to welcome you, Mike.
Okay, thanks. Good to be here.
Maybe you could just introduce yourself and tell a little bit about your backstory before we get started.
Well, I suppose I'm someone who really, really loves traveling. So once I got started, I headed out into Central America when I was quite young. And it was cheap back then. It was just after the wars and all the problems there. So it was exceptionally cheap and lots of fun. And I found out that it was a lot easier than what you would think if you read the news reports. Because news tends to portray foreign countries as extremely dangerous and full of thieves and stuff. And there's a little bit of that. But I found that mostly people are friendly, and it was really a lot of fun. So I just kept on going, and I've been doing it my whole life now.
Why do you think the media portrays foreign countries that way?
I think that it has more impact, and they really go for impact, and they go for emotion. So they look for the bad news. So they'll go into a place, and they'll find the most horrible things that would be the most shocking, and they report on that. So like for instance, I met foreigners whose opinion of Canada was that it's full of aggressive grizzly bears and ice storms destroying the electrical system. And that's because that's all they see on the news, right? So, if you apply it now to other countries, you see that the other ones are in the same circumstance. And all you'll hear about them is the bad things going on. If there's rebels or cannibals or whatever it is, that's what the public image will be. But it's, most people are friendly and there's a lot of interesting things. And you can usually, with a bit of common sense, travel almost anywhere.
Tell me about that first trip to Central America. Was that the start of your journey, or was that just an independent trip?
Well, I'd actually hooked up with a new girlfriend who had done a little bit of backpacking, and she encouraged me to go down there. And I thought from what I'd seen on the news, I was a little bit apprehensive about it because I thought, when we arrive, won't they just hate us because we're gringos and people will pull out guns, steal our money, and that'll be the end of our trip? And she was saying, no, lots of friendly people and it'll be good. So we went down there, and sure enough, I could get hotel rooms for 3 cents a night. And, of course, there were a few attempted thieveries and stuff, but nothing too bad.
Three cents a night.
Running up volcanoes, and, yeah, it was just fantastic.
Wow.
At that time in Managua, it was the army was in control, but they were going to have a vote soon. So they put up giant silhouettes of silhouettes of black soldiers with assault rifles pointing down, and they put them all around the city. So wherever you look, you see a soldier looming above you. And the cathedral had its roof burned off, and it was infested with a gang of cocaine dealers who were armed with AKs. And if they didn't like the look of you, they wouldn't let you into the cathedral to look around. So they actually desecrated the altar, them or someone else. And it was just interesting to see. I guess it was at the time when their civilization was collapsing for a while. But, yeah, it was a lot of fun to go around. And even in those circumstances, no one was trying to shoot us or anything. So I learned from there that it doesn't matter what you hear in the news. You can do all these countries.
Yeah, I've noticed even on articles about you, like Daily Mail, Huffington Post, they make a big deal of you having machine guns pointed in your face.
Yeah, that happens a lot, but usually it's just because police are quite aggressive, or sometimes you get people suspect you're a spy. But if you just joke around with them, you can almost always get your way out of that, talk your way out somehow or make friends with them.
Right, just a little bit of rapport, like, hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, and especially if you can get them to laugh a little bit. Usually they let you go. I mean, I've had more trouble coming to Heathrow than I've had in some of these countries. Like, you'd expect that a place like Somalia would be the worst, but really, coming to Heathrow, I've been detained up to 9 hours. I think I had 1 9-hour detention, a couple sevens, 3 or 4 was quite common.
Wow.
But just recently, they don't detain me anymore. So it was like a year or 2 years ago, I was coming through, and it looks like they were going to detain me, and they were trying to deport me. And then something came up on the computer screen, and they said, actually, Mr. Bound, you're free to go. I said, okay, they put something on their file now. I guess they figured they've used hundreds or even 1,000 man hours interrogating me, so they decided that was enough.
The only place I ever had trouble getting into is actually Canada, across the border, because they saw my stamps in the passport, and they're like, wait, who just, travels to Asia for 8 months or whatever? And they're like, there must be something suspicious about you. And
yeah, well, I had that trouble too. That one time coming into Toronto, I was just coming back from South America.
Yeah,
and they were getting really hostile, and they were looking through my backpack, and in the bottom of the bag they found some you know, that talcum powder that sometimes you can use for, you know, if your feet get smelly. And they said, what's this? And I said, oh, yeah, I used to own some neoprene, like, diving shoes. But they kind of get stinky after you went in the water. So, you know, I was just putting that in them, this talcum powder. You can even see it's written there. And he said, we don't think so. We suspect it's drugs. And I said, okay, suspect all you want, but it's talcum powder. And he said, we're running this through a machine. And they ran off. Then they came back and started yelling at me, saying, we've determined this is 100% pure cocaine. And they said, we're about to put you in handcuffs. You're going to jail right now. And they kept yelling and yelling for minutes. And then I said, well, you know, you want to sniff some? Go ahead. It's talcum powder, right? And finally, they just said, okay, you're free to go. So, you know, it was all just BS.
Do you ever get nervous or fearful in these types of situations?
Well, sometimes I feel a little bit nervous. Like one time in northern Iraq, I was surrounded by Americans. And they were getting a little bit hostile, like asking me, what are you doing in Iraq, you know, and pointing their guns and whatnot. But I managed to joke around with them a little bit, and then things went better after that.
Oh,
I think they
American
might have been 101st
soldiers?
Airborne or 10th Mountain Division, because it was in Mosul.
Okay. So those were American soldiers that were giving you a hard time?
Yeah. That was actually in a restaurant in Mosul, and they cut the power. Then they burst through the door, and they all had Petzl lights and, you know, flak jackets full, you know, everything, grenades, guns, everything else. And they started hassling people inside the restaurant. And I could see it wasn't official American policy to do so, because when the commander was in the room, they were really polite. But then he'd step out for some reason, and then the kids would be, you know, shoving their assault rifles into people's stomachs and saying, shut up or I'll shoot you, like this, yelling at people. They were hassling an Iraqi couple that were having a wedding there. Then the commander would come back in the room, and suddenly they're all polite again. Because, you know, they're just kids, right? And sometimes they're from small towns and maybe not that educated a background, and then you give them guns and put them in a foreign place, and it's their first experience of a foreign place. They're going to maybe go, you know, a little bit more than what the government would want. So I could tell it wasn't official American policy, but they were annoying a lot of Iraqis. But then when they found out I was a foreigner, they surrounded me and started to make an interrogation as well.
Were you in any of the near the battle zones there, or?
Yeah, there was battle zones everywhere, because I was just wandering around Iraq hitchhiking. So I dressed like an Iraqi, and then I wasn't speaking. And then I'd wander around, and as a result, they didn't know that I wasn't an Iraqi, because I can kind of pass for Arab sometimes. I can't pass for Pashtun, though. I tried that out in the parts of Afghanistan that are controlled by the Taliban.
Do you wrap
a shirt
around
your
head or
something?
Do you wrap like a towel around your head or something like that?
Well, no, I dressed like a northern Afghani at that point. You know, when I was in Afghanistan, it didn't work. But for Iraq, I just put on like a T-shirt and kind of cheap jeans. And then I'd look at people's facial expressions, and I'd adopt the same facial expression. And if I saw something really interesting, like you know how like cruise missiles, when they strike a building, it's a 1,000-pound warhead can twist the whole like structure of the building. They can really do a lot of damage. Whereas the 500-pound bombs tend to take bites, almost like a bite out of a crispy apple. It'll take that out of a reinforced concrete structure. So if you see like a bunch of bomb blasts and then a cruise missile, and it's quite interesting to see the difference between the two, you know, for damaged buildings in Baghdad, you might be inclined to stare at it. But I would be really careful thinking, okay, an Iraqi's not going to do that. So I would just glance as if, that's the most boring thing. I see that every day, right? Then I might go around the block and look again. But I wouldn't want to sit gawking at things because, you know, I didn't want to be revealed as a foreigner. Yeah, and it worked pretty good. Sometimes the kids would figure out in bazaars and they'd say, Americani, Americani. And I'd try to go over them and say, no, no, no.
You must be one of the best or most studious students of humanity, I think, because you've encountered so many different people and so many different types of people than anyone.
I would try to pay attention to the people I meet, and I try to take on some unusual situations you're in. You can treat them as learning situations. Like, for instance, often third world people are really trying to rip you off. And it doesn't mean that that's what third world people are like. It's just that the ones who tend to rip people off would tend to congregate around foreigners. So you tend to meet a lot of these people. And to my view, that's a very cheap, very excellent learning experience. Because imagine how much you'd have to pay someone to enroll you in something where you're trying to learn whether someone's on the up and up or whether they're trying to scam. And you had like hundreds and thousands of actors coming through that were trying to scam you or not scam you. And you're trying to watch their facial expressions and figure out which is which. Well, in the third world, for almost free, you get this all the time. Because the guys who are trying to sell you, like rent you a bicycle, or they're trying to sell you some fruit, some of them are scammers and some of them are not, and you get to figure it out. And if you pay really close attention to the way they word things or the expressions that flicker across their face, after a while you get to know who's a good person and who's not.
Their face is a little bit more tense, or they have an evil look in their eye.
Yeah, and even just little micro expressions, or there's like it's tenseness in certain areas where they're trying to mask, you know, the fact that they're snickering at the fact that they're scamming.
Right.
So, yeah, eventually you can get really sensitive to this. And it doesn't mean you're really aware of what they're doing. It's just you have an intuition. So let's say you go up and there's certain people who might be renting out push bikes, let's say. But you can tell which ones are scammers and which ones are on the up and up, and you'll just talk to those ones. So as a result, if you're sensitive to this kind of thing and develop this sort of intuition, you can pass yourself from good person to good person, and you won't contact the ones who maybe want to drug you and rob you or whatever, what else they might do, rip you off quite severely or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I noticed that a little bit too in Vietnam, in some of the tourist areas like Saigon. I think the district's called Pham Nhu Lao, I believe.
Yeah.
That Vietnam has got like the worst cases of pickpocketing of anywhere, and just a lot of these guys just loitering on the streets, you know, with, you can just kind of tell that they got their hands in their pockets and they're just kind of standing around looking for an opportunity, I've noticed.
Yeah, and also on the beaches, or back when I was there, which might have been, could have been late 90s, I'm going to guess, might have been mid 90s too. Anyway, it's quite a long time ago, but there used to be prostitutes on the beaches. And they would come up to you, and sometimes they'd be trying to, like, grope you as you're walking along. And some guys are not strong enough in terms of pushing them away and trying to get rid of them because they think, oh, it's kind of irrelevant. They keep walking. But really what they're trying to do is grab your testicles and crush them. Oh. And then the rest of the girls will steal your wallet or wherever else you go and run away with it. So, yeah, that was one of the tricks back then. I'm not sure if they were still doing it when you went.
They kind of like fatten you up for the kill a little bit, huh?
Yeah. You know, I try to avoid prostitutes as much as possible, but there are a lot of them through some countries anyway. And they can be quite thieving and problematic, so you gotta watch out for that sort of thing.
Would you say you've developed a heightened sense of awareness because of all the places you've been? Like you're more observant?
Yeah, but it's kind of like I have a bit of my brain running on being heightened in awareness in terms of safety, but I'm not even conscious of it. So, you know, I can go along and appear quite lackadaisical, but really just part of my brain is just humming along to make sure that everything's good. And if I get a bad feeling about a town, I'm not going to go out there. Like, for instance, I was in one town in Colombia, and I was with 7 or 8 other backpackers I met, and they were quite fun. So we were traveling together as a group. And we were walking along the coast, and there was this – we were all sitting drinking beer then and looking out over the sea. And this guy was coming over, and already I was a bit suspicious of him because the village dogs were jumping up and biting him, like not just barking at him, but actually jumping up and like sinking their fangs into him, and he had to beat them away. And this was kind of odd, so I was thinking already he might be someone who's kind of nasty, or, you know, dogs often are quite good judges of people. But anyhow, he comes up and he asks if we want to buy any cocaine, and everyone in our group said no, so he walked away. But then one of my friends next to me said, oh, do you see what he dropped? I'm like, oh, I hadn't noticed that, and he pointed out that he dropped a little bag of what, like white powder, but, you know, kind of discreetly behind a bush that was near to us. And so then I said, okay, let's get out of here. This is some sort of a scam. So we got up, and we could see that actually police were coming over right then. So, you know, I knew what kind of scam it was. If he comes up and tries to sell cocaine, if nobody buys, he drops a bit in a place where you can't see. Then the police come up, and they search, and they find it, and they go, aha, all of you in jail. And I found out later the scam there was they would ask $3,000 or whatever they thought they could get for you to get out of jail. So, you know, after that, you know, some other guy, especially a younger guy who's in our group, was saying, oh, let's go out tonight and go to the bar. And I thought, no, this town, you know, is not a good feeling for me. I'm just going to stay in. Because sometimes you see, like, if the police were that corrupt, I wasn't interested in going to a bar there. Because I can go to a bar whenever I want. But I'd rather go in a bar where, you know, things are a little bit more normal in terms of police activity.
Wow. So you take very calculated risks, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Calculated risk is what it's all about.
Yeah.
Yeah, like doing Puntland was similar. You know, I took a calculated risk for going there as well. Because, you know, like a lot of people, even the Somalis, and even Somalis who were in the Somali government were saying, as soon as I arrived in Puntland, I'd be immediately grabbed because the people there were the pirates. And they'd fling me in jail and try to keep me from ransom, or perhaps they'd shoot me. And I thought, no, once again, I don't think that's true. Even though it was Somalis who were telling me that, I said, no. I was thinking, no, I don't think so. And sure enough, it wasn't. But it was a little bit of trouble to get in there. But I did some prep. You know, I went and I found a Puntland liaison officer and got his card and found as much information as I could. But the thing is, it's impossible to perfectly research a potentially dodgy country because you find that all you get when you research it on the internet or through talking to people are data points. And if you graph those data points, they'd be almost like roughly bell-shaped, but not entirely. They're sort of like the things that would be more expected or more average have more data points there, and the ones that are more extreme, a little bit less. So it's a weird sort of mountainous sort of hill if you were to graph it. But the more you try and search for more information and the more hours, tens of hours you put in, you just get more data points, but in the same shape. So it shows that really no one knows for sure what the situation is. And the only way to really do is what you got to do is just prepare as best as you can and head on in.
A lot of people just research and rehash the information.
Yeah, so additional hours of research don't help after a certain point. I think you can do 2 or 3 days of research for a dodgy country, but past that, you're not really getting – you're just getting opinions, or you're getting things that are true or not, but you can't separate what's true from what's not. So, you know, at a certain point, you just got to go and go for it.
Well, I think we make such a big deal of the physical dangers, you know, the machine guns and the so on and the so forth, but I think the existential bullets are probably more difficult to dodge, wouldn't you say? I mean, you must have dealt with them constantly. Do you ever wonder, like, you're on the road, what am I doing? Did I make a mistake taking this journey? Do you ever worry about the future, or how did you overcome these inner demons, you know, or these inner fears?
Yeah, I guess one of the toughest ones would be loneliness, because sometimes you don't meet anyone who speaks your language for like a month, month and a half. And you just have all these odd experiences, but you don't even know what to make of them. You know, you can file them away somewhere under weird experiences, which, you know, eventually you get thousands of them. But, yeah, you know, sometimes I would get the thought of, oh, shouldn't I be trying to settle down somewhere or get married or things like that, like my brothers have done. But luckily, I'm quite resistant to loneliness. So it didn't affect me as strongly as it would have some other people, because I used to go out into the bush and live alone, sometimes for several months. Or I think the longest I ever did might have been 5 or 6 months. But I've done quite a lot of just going in the bush, living off the land, not speaking, not seeing a human for ages and ages. Like I've gone 86 days without speaking, without even seeing a person. So this gets you used to an extreme form of loneliness. And then in comparison, the type of loneliness you get in even very wilderness-focused third world areas is not as bad as that.
Why did you go into the bush for 6 months? Were you looking for something? Were you on a spiritual quest?
I guess in a way I was. I was looking for a type of knowledge which was non-conceptual. So I don't know if you ever read Godel, Escher, Bach, and Eternal Golden Braid by Douglas R. Hofstetter.
Say the title one more time.
Godel, Escher, Bach.
Okay, I haven't read that, no, but I'll look it up.
Oh, okay. It was quite a famous book, I think in the 80s or 90s. A lot of people were reading it. It was someone who did it, you know, quite a good discussion that involves both Eastern and Western ways of looking at the world. But in a way, so he's discussing Zen methods, but also Western ways of development of computer science. And he's trying to discuss the nature of consciousness as a result. And, you know, in the course of reading the book, it can sometimes take a long time to read because you have to learn number theory in the course of reading it. But, you know, I thought that was quite interesting. And he was sort of hinting at that there was an Eastern way of knowledge that involved non-conceptual knowledge. Now, he didn't delve very far into that, but I found it intrigued me, especially as a few other books I'd read on the subject. So I thought that I would make my own form of meditation by going just in a natural environment and away from anything conceptual for a long period of time. And sure enough, it had a lot of extremely mind-bending effects.
Such as?
Let me think. Okay. Well, for going in the bush, so after 10 days, so they're completely alone and you're not around anything conceptual. You're not in a temple or in a house or anything like that. You're just, you know, sleeping in the mud, picking berries, catching fish. You're not seeing any humans or anything. Well, after 10 days, you start to get a little bit of time distortion. Like, you don't really know what time it is anymore. You have to follow the moon and the sun at that point. And then after about 24, 25 days, you lose a habit you don't even know that you had, which is that you're used to compressing thoughts into something that's succinct enough, it's conceptual enough that you can put a word to it. And then if you put a bunch of these words in a row, you've got a sentence, you can speak. But if you're never around people and never encounter any people, the conceptual habit fades until eventually you don't have that habit. And instead, your thoughts go much deeper into your brain. They go much more evenly between your hemispheres. And then this leads into the next effect, which is about 35 days. Your waking and sleeping become very similar. So you're vividly dreaming and intensely aware while you're sleeping. So you're aware of all the movements of animals. You know, if a deer tiptoes along eating tiger lilies in the morning without surprise, your eye notes the lack of tiger lilies in the line where the deer went. But that was your dream, but the dream was also reality. But then in the daytime, you're daydreaming. But by following your daydreams, you get everything done that you need to get done. So after a while, you're not even – I've never met anyone who can go past 65 days and maintain a self. So past that amount, you don't have a self at all. You're at one with nature. So I found it quite fascinating. So I did it several times. I mean, never as deeply as the one really long time, but I did it several times, and I look for opportunities where I can go in for a few months if possible.
Did you have any external focus or outlet for those thoughts during that period?
I used to write them down. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of philosophical musings and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, and I turned it into a novel as well, which I stuffed into the top drawer. I looked at it a few weeks ago. Yeah.
Have you shown anyone your novel?
No, actually. Oh, no, I showed two people. But I was thinking, I want to turn this novel into a book. Oh, no, three people, actually, because I asked an older brother who writes books. And he says, books, but for an unknown person writing a book, maybe you can make $5,000. And I respect his knowledge of books because he's written six or seven. So I thought, oh, okay, it's not actually a lot of money. So then I thought, well, I can always fix it up and make it into a book. So I showed two other friends and I said, I want you to, I've got to cut this by about a third. It's kind of overwritten. But they came back to me with diametrically opposite advice of what to cut and what to keep. And I thought, oh, that's kind of frustrating. What I really need is an editor. So I ended up just sticking it in the top drawer and I left it there at my mom's house.
Do you feel like you still maintain that oneness with the universe, even when you come back to society, even though you're back in Canada?
Well, you actually have to work hard at not maintaining it, oddly enough. Because when you come back, you're bush crazy. And that means you feel really, really sketchy all the time. And why you feel sketchy is because it's so intensely interesting that you're seeing people again and they're speaking. And you're so interested in, you're like, oh, I almost forgot about that concept, people, society. You're so interested in that you're focusing like with laser power on what people are saying. But you must have 10, 20 times the normal amount of focus. It's like every second is a teachable moment. And as a result, you get really, really deep insight into the psychology of why people say what they say. So when someone makes a sentence in a certain way, you see what words they may have picked up from 10 minutes ago that someone else said, and what kind of slant that gives on it, that the fact they chose that word instead of another, or you even can, when they stop, pause saying something for like a tenth of a second, you'll know what words they're choosing between. It's like you have this really, really deep insight, almost equivalent as if you studied their dialogue as if it was a novel, as someone who's a professional at studying these sort of things and had all this deep insight into a novel. Well, in the same sense, you get a real-time insight into why people say what they say and what their social reactions are and interactions between each other. And it makes you feel really sketchy because it's almost like reading minds in a way. Yeah, so you got to work really hard to squash that. And the thing is, it's one for one if you're good at it. And I was quite good at it. So if I went up for 6 months, I could get normal in 6 months. But for most people, I'm not sure it might take much longer.
It's very interesting. Have you ever heard of – you obviously know Nietzsche, right? He wrote the book Thus Spake Zarathustra.
And I've read parts of it. I don't think I've read the whole thing.
Well, I know Zarathustra did a similar experiment. He went off into the wilderness and lived as a hermit for a while because he was running away from what he saw as the excesses of man, the greed, the sinfulness. And he returned with a renewed love for man and a new message for the direction that he thought humanity should go.
Okay, well, that's pretty good. That's the way I've always felt, though, is I'm always positive about humans, even when I see them doing nasty things. Because I know they're doing it for a reason. Like, for instance, even take greed. Most people don't like greed. But in actual fact, you need greed to develop an economy. And an economy like Papua New Guinea is, there's a lot of suffering right now in a lot of third world situations because they don't have enough greed. Like, there's a certain amount of greed you need to run an economy. If you don't have enough greed, you can't do it. And the example would be, like, if you go into the highlands of Papua, you'll notice that there's a lot of people would just be sitting around and not working very hard on things. Because in their society, if you gain anything, it has to be shared to everyone else who's in who speaks your dialect. They call it the one talk. So it'd be the people who speak the same as you. And whatever you gain, they can just come and ask you for it, and you have to give it to them. So as a result, it means that people generally don't go hungry because you can just go and ask for some sweet potatoes from someone, or you can ask for this, ask for that. But also people are not likely to work very hard to try to develop a company or to try to make things more efficient because all the gains from that will just be given to, everyone around them. And what they'll get is the extra work and stress and everything else. So you kind of get these lethargic, somewhat backward societies. Now, in a way, they're lethargic and backward. In another way, they're very well adapted to long-term coexistence in their ecosystem. So I tend to look at it both ways. And usually for most things that are cultural adaptations, you can look at it both ways. You can see why it would develop and how it was positive. And you can also see how maybe it's not so useful if you're trying to modernize.
That's very interesting stuff. Which were some of the most interesting villages or cultures that you lived among? You mentioned Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. I like the pygmies are quite interesting, the Bambudi pygmies. Yeah, that was fascinating to see. Because they were I was living with the ones who hunt with net and spear. Now, my friend had lived also with the ones, briefly with the ones who were poison arrow hunters. But I was only with the net and spear hunters. But yeah, they're quite interesting. I'd go out and try to hunt antelope with them.
You adopt the skills and traits, I mean, the customs of the cultures? When you live on?
A little bit. I mean, I'm not going to be a hunter the way a pygmy is. I mean, they're extremely skilled. Sometimes they would just notice somehow an antelope sleeping in the jungle, and they'd all go surround it with nets. And then they just scare it, and it would have to run into one of the nets, and they go and get it. And there's no way I would notice an antelope at this point. I mean, I used to be quite good at noticing deer or things, but you know, a separate species like that I've not grown up with, it would be quite hard. So, you know, there's no way I could actually hunt like a pygmy. But I go along with their hunts, and I try what I could. You know, I'd help herding the animals into the nets.
You must have done quite a bit of that then, of hunting and eating what you've killed, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But I tended not to kill big animals because I was often on my own or with small groups. So, you know, I wouldn't be out going for anything really large. Because, you know, you kind of need almost like a home and a place to store it and a deep freeze and all that if you're going to go after big stuff like elk and whatnot.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'd often fish or snare small animals, things like that. Yeah, it gave me something to talk about with a lot of these tribal people I'd meet. Or even ones like the Yakuti in northern Russia. You know, I couldn't speak Yakuti, but we knew what we were talking about because they'd be showing me where they would put snares. And I knew that that's what they were showing me. And, you know, I could even guess, even though I didn't know their names for different animals, I could guess what animals they were getting in various areas. So we talk about hunting and gathering, I suppose, even though, you know, even without language, we could talk about hunting and gathering.
Do you pick up some of the languages as you go?
I try to, but there's so many languages on Earth. So, you know, I must know, I know a few words in lots and lots of languages. I tried for Russian a little bit, but now my Russian's fading. But, you know, I put a few months of effort into that. I put a few months into Spanish, but now that's fading. Into French also, but that's fading as well. Because if you don't use it, you know, it slowly goes down. And then, but then what I find is if I'm back in the environment where I need to use that language again, it comes back up again and I can get by.
I read that you've been to Thailand 50 times. Do you know any Thai?
No, because most of those times through Thailand, I think I might have been using that as an example of a place I passed through quite often. Because I was using Bangkok as a base of operations for getting visas for nearby countries. So I was in and out of Bangkok quite a few times, but I only really traveled around Thailand, I think, 4 times. And quite often I'd be there because, like a friend said, you're meeting here. And, of course, it'd be someone who wanted to go out to the beach and drink beer. So probably half my time in Thailand was drinking beer.
Good.
But I remember some funnest places, like Cave Lodge was really fun, Pai in the north. Koh Chang even used to be really, really fun.
Yeah, yeah. Pai is still pretty fun. I was there not too long ago.
Yeah, is it expensive now? I mean, how much did it cost to rent a typical hut on the beach?
No, it's actually not too expensive. Depending where you go, Chiang Mai is really cheap in the north of Thailand.
Oh yeah, I've been up in there. Yeah,
yeah, so Pai is pretty cheap too. I mean, you can get a hostel bed for about 100 baht, so that's about
okay.
A little less than $3.50. So.
Okay, that's pretty good then. So it's still about the same though. I mean, it used to be like full-on hotel rooms that you'd be getting, but sort of a poor quality, but, you know, always for about $5, $6. And there wasn't really hostels at the time, but now it's a new thing coming in.
Yeah, same thing in Vietnam, too, about $5 a night for the hostels, dormitory, you know, 8 beds. But it also, you get breakfast as well, which is pretty nice.
Okay.
One place.
So probably the difference is that now it's a hostel and you're getting a bed in a dorm, but otherwise the same cost as what it used to be when it used to be hotel rooms.
Yeah, I actually did quite a bit of hostels. I did quite a bit of couch surfing as well, but it wasn't always as convenient to couch surf. But
yeah, couch surfing is a little bit – I never got into that because I was always used to hosteling before that. I used to do the actual couch surfing where you just meet people and just go couch surf. That's probably how I did most of it. Yeah, all around Europe like that.
But, yeah, it's totally different traveling these days, I think. Well, for the young traveler who has an app and, you know, they log into the Couchsurfing forum and Rolf Potts.
I've even seen some hostels. There's a big difference in hostel culture because there's many hostels where I've been there once and then I've been there again like 10, 15 years later. And I was always shocked to see, like, when I'd be there the first time, let's say back in mid-90s, it'd be a whole bunch of people talking to each other, and often they'd have instruments, and then there'd be a bit of beer drinking, and then people would be, you know, getting to know almost everyone in the room, and a common room was really, really quite socially lively. But just lately, I'd be going back to some of these places, and I'd be seeing, okay, it's the same common room it used to be. It even looks the same, but it's full of a whole bunch of people just staring at their screens. So they have, you know, either little laptops, or they have some sort of a smartphone. And they'd be staring almost like medieval scryers with their crystal balls. They'd be looking at these screens going, ooh, you know, a bit of a glow over their face. And no one would be talking to anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, it's too bad. If only they could put them away, you know. And a lot of these people, they're young backpackers. They'll come from Europe or Australia and just go from, you know, one air-conditioned bus to the next hostel, the next backpacker area. Go out and drink in with their travel mates and not really live among the locals like you do, for sure.
Well, yeah, it's a different culture for sure, but I think it's in transition now, so something good will probably come of it, but I don't know what that is yet. Yeah. But it's definitely different. And in the sense of the traveler being away from their friends and family back home, I'm not sure they're getting any of that. Because, you know, if they're on Skype constantly with their mother and all their friends, and every time something happens, an hour later they're calling up to describe it with photos and maybe even video of it, I'm not sure in what sense there's really any distance between them.
Right.
So, you know, it's quite different from that point of view from traveling. Just like if we go back, let's say, 150 years ago, when some of the early explorers would go out traveling, you know, maybe years would pass before they'd have any contact with their home country.
Right.
And, you know, when I started traveling, it's more like months could pass. And now, you know, then it sort of transitioned to days would pass. And now it seems like not even hours pass, but they're not, you know, updating something in IT.
All of us have to be communicating, or we have texting, or whatever it is. I don't know if you know Rolf Potts, but he wrote the book Marco Polo Didn't Go There. And yeah, he's actually a travel writer too. But the inspiration for the title came when he noticed that he was trying to recreate Marco Polo's journey across Central Asia, and he realized, you know, this isn't Marco Polo's era anymore. You know, I can't recreate this journey because the world is so much different than it was then for the traveler. And he's like, well, I just have to embrace it. And so rather than going on that journey, he decided that he wanted to crash the Leonardo DiCaprio set in the south of Thailand for they're filming the beach there.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was his modern day adventure. Like, he wanted to crash the film set, but they had patrolled armed guards around the island and stuff. And so for him, that was adventure because it's more of modern day travel.
Yeah, I guess you've got to take your era in mind, because certain things become impossible and other possibilities open up. So I guess that's what I meant by saying I think something good will come of all this IT in the end, but people are still in the process of working out what that's going to be. So it seems a bit ridiculous now. Everyone's so interested in it. They're all just looking at their screens and not talking to each other. But I'm sure some new benefit will come out of it.
Well,
you know, it's certainly
a
glorious time for the vicarious traveler. Because now they have all these blogs they can follow, and or friends that want to travel if they can't or not up to it.
Yeah. Well, Google Maps actually allows you to visit the places virtually speaking of vicarious travel. But here we are looking at our screens and talking to one another. So I guess something good is coming out.
Right? Yeah, you got to adapt. And it's like, you know, sometimes if you go to a country and you have the wrong attitude, like let's say you go to Tokyo and you want to see wilderness. Well, you really have the wrong thing in mind, and you're going to be disappointed. And it's the same thing with this guy you were describing who was trying to do the Marco Polo. And eventually decided, okay, well, what I had in mind is no longer possible because times have moved on. So it was really good that he redirected and did something more modern and, you know, had some fun out of it.
So, Mike, let me go back to you for a second. what would you say has been driving you for these last 23 years? What kept you going? Why did you want to keep doing this?
Well, I guess I had so much fun when I would come to somewhere that I'd never seen before, and like new physical features or societies or historical or even just new people to talk to. That it was so much fun that I felt I just wanted to keep going, even though according to a classical calculation of what someone in a Western society would want, I was making a mistake. Because you think I should be trying to get a house and get married and get a career and all of this. And I didn't bother with any of that. I was just traveling along on a shoestring budget. But, you know, I felt I was learning enough, and it was interesting enough that I wanted to keep going. And also, I think there's billions of people have done the conventional thing. So, you know, I don't mind, you know, to be one person who's trying to do something else, something different.
When did you fully commit to doing this for 23 years? When did you know that you wanted to keep doing it?
I think about maybe 12 or 13 years ago, I was fully committed. So it's been like constant travel since then, like absolutely full on. Whereas before that, I'd sometimes go and visit some people I knew, or maybe I'd drop in on London, go to a few parties with people. I mean, I still do that, but you know, I would do that a little bit more in the early part. So I wasn't as committed. I was having a lot of fun traveling, but it also was doing a little bit of business in Indonesia and you know, visiting people in Europe and whatnot. But yeah, past 13 years, it's been full on.
And did you have some goal in mind, or what were you looking for, something? Or
I think I vaguely had in the back of my mind that I wanted to properly visit everywhere on Earth. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of like, you know, just something that wouldn't that be fun to do? I didn't know how feasible it was. And, you know, it wasn't until quite recently that I thought, okay, maybe I'll be able to do it. Because I learned quite quickly that the world is enormous. It's like, you know, I was traveling for like the first 5 years of traveling. Then I looked at how much I'd actually done. I go, wow, there's a lot to do. Like, I think it takes like 3 years for Africa, 2 years for South America. And this is traveling full on. Asia must be 6 or 8. It's absolutely enormous. Even for Europe, it's going to be 2 or 3 years for Europe. So you just add all these up and you can see that it takes a long, long time. And that's something I didn't understand about, you know, there's actually hundreds of people who've been to every country. But I'm thinking, how could they possibly have done it? Because there's just simply not enough, like, there's not enough time in anyone's life if they're living any kind of a normal life. Right. But what I discovered from meeting a lot of them is that actually what they've done is gone and stuck their foot over a border and went, ooh, okay, mark that off. And that's almost the opposite of travel to me. So, you know, I didn't want to do that.
You don't really get the true benefit, which is, would you say that you've been reinvented yourself, or, I don't know, like if you leave one place and go to another, like you learn new things about yourself and you from your experiences and the people you meet?
Yeah, I guess in that sense, it's very educational.
Yeah.
So I've learned more and more and more about how the world works, and especially about how different cultures work and how different people together can develop ideas, and then it becomes a culture. Because you can see how different cultures are similar to each other, and you know, how religions are spreading, all kinds of things. So I feel I've got some pretty good insight into that sort of thing. Like, for instance, you know, look at the Christian religion. It seems quite mysterious. But if you travel around to all these countries and you visit all these museums and talk to all these people, after a while you can kind of understand, for political reasons, how it would develop. Like, it seems to me that, for instance, for Christianity, it would be it's similar in a way to the Sikh religion, where you had you know, you have Hindus on one side and Muslims on the other. You have some people in the middle who find, you know, they have a guru who's teaching something that's kind of midway between the two. They're going, okay, let's split the difference and have something that's midway between these two religions. And it's very useful that way, because then you're less likely to be attacked by either group. And I think a similar thing happened with Christians, because they had angel worshippers on one side, the ancient Persians. They had virgin worshippers on the others, the Anatolian Greeks. And they had, like, Old Testament Jews also to the south, in the area around the Caucasus Mountains. And that's when it first became a political religion. So you had the Armenians and the Georgians and people like that were the first to declare they're Christians. Because if you think about it, Christianity is like, it's like the Jewish religion, but they tacked in the angels from the Persian, and they also put in the virgin aspect from the Greeks. So it's almost like saying, we want to be our own little country here, and we're in the mountains, so we're a little bit defended. But, you know, there's a great history of all these other groups coming and attacking them. So they want to be able to say to the angel worshippers, hey, we're a bit like you, don't attack. Or to the Jews, the same thing, and to the Greeks as well. Hey, we've got a virgin too. So, and it seemed to me from looking at the development of all these religions that's how they get going. So they usually get going for political reasons, because you have thousands of different gurus and shamans and everyone else with all these ideas. But the only time something's going to become a state religion and really push to become big is where there's a political advantage to it. So, you know, the Jews developed that way. The Islamic faith as well. So, you know, things make sense after a while if you're able to look over the whole world and see how they developed and see the scope of history.
And just simple upbringing, too, the culture that they're brought up in. You know, it's all they really know. I remember going to Malaysia and just being really impressed by the Muslims there that I encountered, how welcoming and friendly they were. But they thought that Buddhists were violent, you know, because of what was going on in Burma.
Yeah, it's true. I've met some violent Buddhists before. They're often not violent, but yeah, there are some. Like in Sri Lanka, I was there during the war. I guess it would be early 90s, it could have been. But anyhow, they're still battling. Mm-hmm. And you had some quite aggressive monks there, which is kind of funny because, you know, completely opposite to what you'd expect a Buddhist monk to be. But then again, if you keep in mind that the empire of Ashoka, that was one of the first empires to be, in the name of a king of peace, to go and attack everyone and build an empire. So, yeah, so anything can get twisted around that way.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the reason for religions or spiritual teaching, though, is to try to deal with the problems of psychotics. Because when you start to get a very dense groups of populations, like you're farming, so you get a higher density than you would with hunter-gatherer tribes, you get a situation where not everyone can know everyone else. And in these circumstances, people who are psychotic are quite adapted to pushing themselves to the top because no one is aware of what kind of scams they're up to and what sort of nastiness. Because, you know, everyone doesn't know everyone else. So I think that there was, civilization were first developing, there'd be a lot of these psychotic type people putting themselves in charge. Like if you look at the Kama Sutra, for instance, from thousands of years ago, it's basically full of psychotic advice. So you can see that completely psychotic people have got in charge. And if you read like old history of Sumerian and whatnot, it seems that everyone's completely psycho. And I think part of the reason of these development of religions that stress peace and stress mindfulness and whatnot were to try to find a way to cope with this problem.
I think there was a saying somewhere that I read recently that a person is a psycho at first, and then once they gain one follower, they become a leader.
Hmm.
And then once, as they gain more followers, they've started a movement, and then the herd kind of joins along, and then it becomes the new norm.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the religions that would hope that their leader was not necessarily psychotic. Sometimes you can get that. I mean, not always, because I think that power also corrupts people, and they become a little bit more psychotic the more power they got.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the only way that I can find to make sense of history, because when you read through the history of all these nations, which I have, you know, I visit the museums, there's some pretty crazy stuff going on. These old kings that are always torturing and killing and attacking.
I've noticed that many of the most traveled people are also history buffs, and you seem to be no exception either.
I like my history. But I like, you know, with psychology and biology and all these other things as well. So really a learning experience to go around the world that way.
Well, one of the reasons why I want to ask you about reinvention is because I feel like maybe some of the people listening to this or maybe the average person really hasn't stepped outside of their own little shell. You know, they've kind of just been brought up in one culture and, you know, led to think one way and believe one way and think that this is what I got to do with my life. And you must have just blown all those assumptions away completely.
Yeah, slowly over time, but I'd still sometimes be nervous about a continent that I hadn't done before. Like, for instance, example of Africa, the news coming out of there was just horrible. And so I thought, oh, no, might this be an exception to the rule that everything's quite friendly? Because you see just absolutely gruesome news coming from certain parts of Africa. But once I got in there, I thought, oh, most people are friendly, and you can really have a lot of fun and move around, even through the war zones.
Was your fear more abstract, or was it more specific of what could happen to you? Were you worried about being robbed or shot, or what was the fear? Was it more of an abstract sense?
I think that it was kind of an abstract fear because I sort of knew from a rational point of view that it's probable that the news are exaggerated.
Right.
And really things aren't quite as bad as what they're saying. Or maybe they're bad in certain areas, but if you just avoid those areas, you shouldn't have trouble. So I knew this in an abstract sense. But then, you know, it's one thing to know something intellectually and another thing to experience it. So I guess I had a little bit of worry that, oh, what if it turns out that, you know, the news from there is so bad that what if really it is, you know, raging, horrific war at all points? And, you know, so, you know, it was interesting to me to see that disproven as well. And then I found that just traveling to Africa felt like traveling to any other place. I mean, now I probably feel an equal low level of nervousness going to any continent, which, of course, would be near zero for me because, I've had fun on every continent.
Right.
But, yeah, it's pretty hard to get me worried about stuff now.
But in those days, you obviously had to challenge your assumptions of what you thought you knew.
Yeah, so for each new place I'd be going to, I'd have to – each new experience, I'd have to be challenging my assumptions. But I'm not sure if that's going on as much now. I mean, after, you know, all these – like it's been more than two decades now. You know, after a while, I'm just I find it completely fun to just go into a new place. I don't even bother to get a guidebook in many cases. Or if I do, I don't even look at it unless I have a problem like, oh, when was that boat schedule or something? I might look it up. But generally, a guidebook is just something that would remain in my backpack. And I just go around talking to people and getting advice for what to do, what's fun, and just go and do it.
More of an adventure.
The idea of just going in and doing something, you know, seems more exciting to me now Yes, one thing I don't like is planned out trips. I find they're really you're really limiting your travel experience if you come in and you have some kind of strict plan.
There's no chance for anything impromptu or spontaneous.
Yeah, and that's the maximum fun for traveling. You just might meet someone who suggests something like, why don't you go in the jungle and look at this old ruin? You think, okay, why not? And it wasn't on your plan. And because you had no plan, you actually have the time to do it, because it's not as if in 3 days you have to get a flight somewhere else or whatever. So you can just go and do it, and you might meet people on the way and see fantastic sights, or maybe you'll meet someone else who says they're looking for blood diamonds in the jungle. Do you want to come along? And you go along on that as well. And yeah, just one adventure leads to another.
Going back to the assumptions and so on, would you say that you have a more subjective view of reality now as a result of all these experiences? Because, you know, we have our own perception of – everyone has their own perception of reality that might not actually be true, would you say, based on our presupposed assumptions, like I said. Would you say that you have more of an objective view of reality?
Well, I find I've become extremely open-minded. Mm-hmm. And maybe to the point that it might even annoy some people, because I can talk with someone in Yemen who might have political opinions entirely different to mine. And if someone had just recorded it and they were looking, they say, "Oh, there's Mike. Look at the way he's talking with this person. He seems almost like a terrorist in my view." But I would just be taking them, you know, for who they are, and I'm interested in where they're coming from, and I'd just be speaking to them and not necessarily, you know, getting upset and angry at them when they're presenting a whole bunch of medieval views. Because, you know, I'm very open-minded to the point where I think, okay, I can see that they're coming from a very medieval standpoint here, but I can also understand that, you know, that's the way that person was raised.
Does it ever frustrate you?
It doesn't mean I'd be saying that, you know, nations like America or Canada should be going in this direction or should be, you know, shouldn't be resisting it, but just so that I can understand where they're coming from.
Does it ever frustrate you when you encounter these closed-minded people, and do you still accept them and love them regardless? Because it's...
I do, and I try to use a bit of humor. Like, for instance, once I met a Mongolian who was a Nazi, and I was not surprised, so I just had a bit of fun with him. He was saying, "Yeah, I'm a Nazi." And I said, "You mean that you really like Hitler?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, I love Hitler." And I thought, okay, this is strange. And so of course, I'm having some fun with it, and I say, "You know, don't you know that Hitler is someone who didn't like people who weren't German? If he had you, he'd probably be killing you." He goes, "Yeah, that's what I admire. He kills everyone." And then I said, "Oh, you must really like Chinggis Khan then, because he was killing everyone, you know, who burst out of Mongolia." And he said, "No, I hate Chinggis Khan, because he was killing my clan hundreds of years ago." And I was thinking, oh, okay, like only one more step here and you'd almost get to the golden rule, right? Because just to generalize that feeling, you might understand why some people don't like Hitler.
No, no personal experience with Hitler, but there was with Chinggis Khan, I guess, because of the history, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was asking him, I said, "Well, there's no Jews here in Mongolia, so who are you attacking?" And he said, "The Chinese. I attacked the Chinese." And he was saying how his friends were trying to kill Chinese in the capital. And I was saying, "Oh, well, what can you do? I mean, some of these people are quite like rednecks." And in a way, you know, I'm not trying not to pass judgment on them because it's almost worthless. And in a way, they're kind of going to grow out of it anyway. I don't know. So I'll have a little bit of fun with them. But when you meet people with very extreme viewpoints, you can't really – if you try to have an extreme viewpoint in opposition to them, they're just going to harden their position anyway.
Right. And it's not just Mongolia and Yemen. It's also Canada, America, Europe, anywhere where you can find these types of people, right?
Yeah, there's ways of talking to people without sort of raising their hackles. And there's no sense to think, okay, I'm holier than thou because I'm strongly opposing any viewpoint that doesn't seem good from my point of view. I mean, that's not going to get you any friends, and it's not going to get you anywhere. I think it's more effective to just try to understand where people are coming from and then talk to them and sort of, you know, very subtly try to bring in your own point of view.
Well, like I said before, you must be one of the purest students of humanity in the world, probably, from all the people you've met.
Well, thanks. It could be. I certainly put in the time for it. But.
How are you doing on time? I got about 3 or 4 questions for it.
Yeah, that's okay. Shoot.
Okay. And I was going to say also, too, you must be one of the world's best negotiators as well, based on all the unique situations.
Yeah, I suppose so, except for lately I found that I've given up on the idea of always trying to get the exact proper price. Like, let's say something ought to be $1. Mm-hmm. If I get ripped off and it's $1.20 or something, I'm not one to really make a scene and get very upset to try to get the absolute rock bottom price.
Well, I heard you made a scene when you arrived in Mogadishu. You perform these antics where you're waving around and trying to
stall your time. That's just what the reporter said, though. See, there's another thing you can learn about travel, is that when things come across in a wire report, it's not necessarily very congruent with reality.
Why don't you tell a listener what happened there in case they don't have the context, Mike?
Oh, okay. Yeah, when I was coming into Mogadishu, I managed to talk my way in. And I got into a hotel, the Peace Hotel, and there was a couple of Americans who might have been CIA or something military there. They were experts in fortifications. But there was a raging war all around, so shells going overhead, shots being fired. And there's a Somali guy who says, oh, you know, can I do an article about you? And I said, okay, sure. So we talked a little bit. But I'm not sure that his English understanding would have been good enough to really know how to make a very succinct article about someone who was doing something as unusual as what I was. So, you know, he would... I'd be saying I tried my darndest to see that I could get into the country because the head of the African Union force was trying to kick me out. Now, in his Somali mind, he's going to translate that as I shouted and played tricks to get into the country, because he's thinking that would be what in a Somali translation of trying your hardest would be shouting and playing tricks. But, you know, he wouldn't have known that from a Canadian point of view that what I would have meant is I politely asked and presented my case. So it's like, so for a Somali reading that, they would get an understanding that I was trying my hardest. But from a Canadian point of view, no, it wouldn't be what I was doing. But you can see how these sort of cultural misunderstandings can come into it. And then when he's only got a few sentences to write the thing, it really gets quite compressed. So I didn't think it was, you know, I had a laugh when I saw it, but it's not. It would have been funny for my friends if I had been shouting at the 4,000 African Union forces guarding the airport in all their tanks and guns, let me in, let me in. But no, actually, I can't claim that. In reality, I just politely asked and I said, I've come all this way and, you know, I'll go to a hotel that has some security and all that. And finally, the guy said yes. And I think part of the reason that the commander of the forces said yes is because there was no way to deport me at the time, because the plane that he might have deported me on had a full complement already.
Well, Mike, I think that's something you're just going to have to deal with, is that your legend is going to grow, and it might be a bit detached from the true reality. But
yeah, it's true. I've traveled so much and meeting so many other travelers that I'd often hear stories of things that I'd done just through other groups of travelers, even on other continents talking about it. And I go, oh, that's me you're talking about. But I could see there was some mutation in to the stories. They kind of change over time.
Every good story deserves a little bit of embellishment.
Yeah, there you go.
So let me ask you the question that you probably get asked the most, probably the number one most asked question. How exactly did you finance your travels over these last 23 years? I know you've had a couple of export businesses, but there must have been so many gaps in between where you were hunting for deer or small game, as you said.
And yeah, well, I would try to import-export whenever possible.
Yeah.
But basically, what the main thing I did, though, was really, really reduce the amount of money I have to spend. So, you know, I'm quite content with a $2 or $3 hut to sleep in, or sometimes even cheaper. I don't mind that maybe just a few cans of sardines is all I had for the half-week period when I was going through, you know, one area of the jungle and another. Or just eating local food, which is essentially free. So I have a very strong stomach. So in that way, I brought my expenses down to the point where if you have a bit of money in a bank, often it's not too much different than what you're making on investments. And I was able to put away a little bit of money by I was quite nimble as a very small business doing manufacturing and shipping overseas. So I'd be able to go in and think of products that were kind of unique. Unique enough that, you know, perhaps not too many people or other people to my knowledge have been doing them. Like an example would be, I found this carpenter's box in a museum in Scotland, and it's from 1,000 years ago, but it had a very nice design of a stylized header on. And I thought, that's beautiful. And so I just got photos of it from different angles, and I went to Indonesia and I got it run off, so thousands of them. And I was getting them for about $7 or so. And then I shipped them to Western countries and I'd sell them for something like 42. So it was a huge markup. And then I'd pocket the cash. And I was doing that whenever I see an idea for a good product like that, I'd go and do it. And it didn't slow down my traveling hardly at all, because I'd just come with the pictures of what I wanted to have as a prototype. And then I'd get some craftsmen to build it. So maybe I'm around them for a week. and okay, then it's to my satisfaction. Then I'd get some companies and say, I need 5,000 of this. We'd agree. And then at a certain point, I'd come back and inspect. Okay, they have it. Ship the container. Then it would take a while for the container to go. In the meantime, I'm traveling. So I'm traveling all the time. And then I just arrive in a Western country and sell it.
Do you want to take a second? Sounds like a bit of ruckus.
Oh, yeah. It looks like the dogs are barking. Yeah, so
yeah,
anyhow.
Okay, take your time.
Okay.
Yeah,
so I was able to make a little bit of money. And then I wasn't – ideally, I would have just been living off the interest. But I found out that my lifestyle was sometimes cutting into the interest. Like, for instance, if I had an opportunity to view gorillas and it cost hundreds of dollars or even $1,000, I pay it. Because, you know, when will you get that opportunity again? And it's not like it's going to get any cheaper over time to do something like that. So I would splurge where it made sense to splurge. And as a result, my principal did come down. But yeah, I found that I was able to coast through just with the money I'd made from that.
Well, there must have been many times where you had – not even like a penny to your name, wouldn't you say? Like at least a few.
Yeah, but I don't mind living quite impoverished. That's fine by me. I found I was always able to think of some idea to make a little bit of money.
Because I actually did a feature on in the magazine, our prototype, Heidi Marie Schwermer, who's lived without money for, I don't know, it was maybe 16 years. I can't really recall. But I think that the big thing is, you know, fear of poverty would paralyze a lot of people. You know, they'd be like, you don't seem to mind it, but I think a lot of people would be like, well, I don't want to be in a third world country and, you know, stuck here with no money. What would I do? You know, how would I live? Would I die? You know, would people help me, or would they just like turn their back on me?
You know? Yeah, well, the trick is to not, luckily I've been very healthy, because if I had been someone who had only moderate health or got a lot of tropical diseases, I think it wouldn't have worked. But as it is, I've had very good health. So I hardly ever had to I never had to go to hospital. I've actually never been in a hospital. And I only got malaria twice, and for a very short time. I just took Coartem and sorted it out. And then I'd get maybe Giardia every year and a half or year, depending on where I was. But I could just take Flagyl for that. So it was quite cheap, so I didn't really have medical expenses.
You didn't get any shots or anything when you went to places in Africa or anything like that?
Every so often. I mean, I got the yellow fever. I got a few other ones. But eventually I stopped taking them because I just assumed I'd been exposed to the wild version of most of these viruses. And I think that was the case with a lot of the heps and typhoid and stuff. Yeah, because sometimes I noticed I have a bit of a rash and all that's kind of typhoid-y. But, you know, I'd have that a few times, and then after a while I wasn't getting it. Like I had such a strong stomach that when I was in the Dogon escarpment in Mali, I had this Dogon guy guiding me. And we're eating Dogon food all the time. And there's one dish that I thought, okay, this dish has gone a little bit bad. But I ate it anyway, and so did my guide. And then the next day, my guide was saying, oh, my stomach is so bad. You know, can we stop for a few days for me to rest? And I said, okay, fine. But, you know, my stomach was a little bit off, but it was good. So I was even more resistant to Dogon food than the Dogon.
Wow.
Yeah, so, but I'm not sure. Maybe my stomach has got a bit weaker now because I stopped traveling for a few months. But
right.
I'll soon test it again when I get out.
Okay, I
still
get off to my.
Sounds like it's almost dinner time there for us. So
have a good weekend.
What was this? Sorry.
Oh, I said it sounds like supper's almost ready there for you. So.
Yeah.
I just want to ask you a couple more questions real quick before we wrap up, if that's okay.
Okay.
So, yeah, I just want to ask, if you could go back, what would you do differently if you could go back to where you were 21, 22, 23 years ago?
I think the only thing I'd do is worry less. And it's not as if I worried all that much, but I'd probably worry less about things. But of course, now I'm knowing that everything turned out okay in the end. Because, you know, all my worries about, you know, oh, this country would be impossible, or these people are known to be terrorists, and all this proved to be not true. And if I would have known that while starting out, then I would have had an easier time because I wouldn't even have these low-level worries about what countries might end up in. So I guess I'd do the same thing, but less worry.
What's the opposite of worry? Just faith?
The opposite of worry?
Yeah, would you say it's just faith, faith in the unknown?
I don't know if it's quite faith, but it could be like faith in humanity. You know, that sort of faith might be the opposite of worry.
Interesting. Or just the unknown as well too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've always loved the unknown, so I never had a trouble with that. But it's so much fun. I mean, I've had some friends that I introduced to traveling just a few years ago, and they're saying, oh, no, I wish I would have gone traveling earlier because they had no idea how fun it is. It's one of the all-time fun activities. mean, I had a friend who's a surfer recently, was describing how much fun he has surfing. And he says, you have anything like that in your life? And I was thinking, yeah, traveling. So exactly what he feels when he's on the wave like that coming in. I mean, that's what I feel when I'm, you know, trying to get various buses and hitchhiking and, you know, local transport and all that to get from one country to another. It's just so much fun.
Is this what you knew you always wanted to do when you were just a youth, like a small kid or a small boy?
Not really. When I was young, I was mostly interested in wilderness.
Okay.
So I probably thought I'd be doing something more to do with going out and living in the wilderness, maybe building a log cabin and just, or homesteading in some place 1,000 kilometers from anywhere, or prospecting or something like that. But, you know, after doing quite a lot of wilderness stuff when I was younger, and then going out and living alone in the wilderness a few times, it's almost like I felt I'd seen enough of that, and I wanted to see examples of wilderness in other countries. And that's where it led to all my other interests, like the interest in societies and history and everything else.
Well, I think you've certainly experienced plenty of that.
yeah, it's been good. I can't complain.
Do you think you'll be able to settle in and take on a new path in life now? Or
I guess I'll have to. But I don't know. It could be tough. I mean, I sort of overwintered in Canada, which is quite shocking for me. And I felt it's maybe a little bit too dull for me. So I'm going to have to get out traveling again. Because, you know, people here are, first of all, one thing I noticed with these Western societies, everyone's really old. And so they have all these opinions that you expect old people to have. Because, you know, the average age of Western societies is quite up there. It's probably in the 40s.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm used to places where, you know, the average age might be 14. So it's just a different feel to the whole society. It's much, much younger.
More excitement, more energy, more life.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's that. I like that extra energy in society, the feeling that there's progress.
Right. So no telling what's next for you then, huh?
Not really, no. I'll just make a new plan. But it's the same with when I go to a new country. I don't like to have a plan worked out beforehand. I just like to come in and see what's possible. And it'll be the same thing with my life. I mean, I've got to write a book now. So soon I'll get a contract. Yeah, so it's the same thing with going to a new country. I come in and just try to figure out what's worthwhile and go and have some adventures. And now I'll be doing the same thing with my life. So, you know, something slightly different than travel, but probably equally fun.
When do you expect your book to be ready?
It'll probably take me a year to write it, but I got to decide where to actually write. So I've got to find some place warm and fun and, you know, with an opportunity there for maybe a little bit of solitude as well when necessary. So I haven't decided what country it'll be. And that'll be, of course, depending a bit on what time of the year. Because, you know, different hemispheres are better at different times of the year. Different elevations are too. So I'll just adjust my position on the globe according to what's best and hope that after a year of work I can get it done.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea for a title?
I was thinking I might use a title like Big Planet because, you know, or something that means similar. Because, you know, people are always saying it's a small world, it's a small world.
Right.
But what I found is that actually it's really, really big, almost ridiculously big. The only thing that's small is the world of like convention centers and international airports and major capital cities that various businessmen or NGOs or government people inhabit. And for them, it is a small world. You will be bumping into the person you met before in a conference in another place. And it really, really thinks you'll think that it's a small world if that's where you're traveling. But when you get out into where the average people are living or where the places that people don't even know about. There you can just see it. They're immense. And it just goes on forever. And it can take years and years and years to explore these places where, you know, no one's ever heard of them. But they're intensely interesting and well worth it.
Do you feel like you've packed 50 lifetimes within your one life?
Well, I'm not sure because the other people I meet are usually really interesting as well.
Yeah.
So in a way, I consider myself somewhat because... My dog's just going crazy here. It's because I'm with my brother and his kids are here and there's three dogs and all that. So
no problem.
Kids are coming home from school now.
Yeah,
where was I? What was your question again?
Oh, I just seems like because you've experienced all these different cultures, like you must have packed in so many different lifetimes.
Oh, yeah, but for me, interesting people are normal. Because it's like when you're in these really out-of-way places. Like, for instance, when I was in Congo, I only met four people. And three of them were really, really interesting. Like one of them was there doing his own television program. Another guy was the head of Reuters and agency for the Congo Basin with lots of stories. Another guy was like a Frenchman who was a martial arts expert battling his way across Africa. So I'm used to meeting fascinating people all the time.
Wow.
So I don't know what would happen to me if I had to meet normal people, you know, whatever they might be. Because I don't really encounter them.
Back in Canada.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, I don't want to hold you up too long. I want to say thank you so much for your time.
Okay, you're welcome.
This has been a really exciting interview, and I'm really thankful and fortunate to been able to conduct it. So.
Okay, well, it's been great talking to you as well.
Thank you, Mike.
Where are you going next for travel? Or you're a traveling man, aren't you?
Yeah, actually, I might go back to Asia next month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah, starting in the Philippines. I actually got in a hiking accident in Malaysia. I fell and broke my foot last time.
Oh.
So I didn't get to travel as long as I wanted to, but you know, everything happens for a reason. I came back and I started writing my book, and it's almost finished now. So.
Oh, excellent! How long did it take you to write it?
It's been a little over a year.
Okay, maybe it'll take me a similar time. Then I'm trying to guess what time it will take you, right?
Yeah, the biggest thing is this. Well, one, starting to write, and then as soon as you can, developing the structure, you know, the outline. You say this is this chapter, and I want to touch on this, then this, and then kind of just filling in, working within your outline. Because I find that, you know, if you just sit down and you just try to start from wherever, you get really sidetracked and such. And,
yeah, that's what I'm dealing with now. I've gone through all my old emails and I found hundreds of pages of those, like travel stories. Then I have like several hundred pages of just travel stories.
Yeah.
And then I looked through and found my old notes. I have 3,000 pages of notes. And I thought, wow, I can't even work with this. I can't even get it in my memory. So I reduced that to 40 or 50 pages. That's kind of like a synopsis of what's in my notes. But then even that is too much to load into my memory to try to decide what fits what into different chapters. So I'm sort of wrangling with that now.
Yeah, exactly. And you only have a limited amount of attention that you can devote each day to writing. So you kind of have to be almost a miser, you know, like really selective about what you do, what you focus on.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, if you got any questions or anything, you know, need any feedback or, you know, what you've written, just reach out to me. I'd be happy to help in any way I can, Mike.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Danny.
And just the same for anyone listening to this interview, if they wanted to reach out or get in touch with you, how could they do so? What would you prefer?
Yeah, I guess on Facebook. I'm the only Mike Spencer Bounds, so that's probably the best way. I've got a bunch of photos and things like that up there.
That's Mike Spencer Bound with no R in Bound, just B-O-W-N. Yeah. And you can also check him out on his website, MikeSpencerBound.com, along with a lot of articles about his travels, some of his favorite spots, and a whole bunch of other stories. Okay, Mike, thank you so much for this interview, and best of luck to you.
Okay, you too, Dan. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.